All right. So how many of you went home and started to abstract and plat some of your family deeds? All right. There you go. So did you find that they were pretty different from what we had done in class? A little bit? Not much, but a little bit, yes. Okay.
I pulled a deed from a will that was an inheritance then, and it was being divided into three.
Okay. So,
and I already knew what the original plat looked like because that somebody else did that survey long ago, and so that was being divided by three.
Okay,
so it was interesting.
How did you do it? Did you first plat? You had already platted the original?
No, that was actually somebody else had done that. That was surveyed in the 70s, actually.
So did you then plat the three?
I started to plat the three, and I realized that I needed like five pieces of paper because it was like 500 and some purchases.
And that is where you are going to want to play with the scale.
Yeah.
And as you've done this a number of times, you're going to start to see, okay, if it's this long in this particular type of measurement, I'm going to divide it by whatever and put it in something else, which is exactly why with the one that we platted last week, I had us do it in purchase because I knew it was going to be a nice size for you to see the shape of it. It wasn't going to be so big, and it wasn't going to be a little teeny, teeny thing like that because depending on the scale and the property, it's going to go way big.
It wasn't purchase.
Thank you.
I did all the math and I did everything else, and I only did it was actually four plots because one son got something and like a note somewhere.
Okay.
So I only managed to do one, but somehow there's something that's wrong.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll take a look at it after class and see if we can figure it out. Michael, how did you do?
I did pretty well. I found this is a the place where my wife's family's house was in Cheltenham Township. And I was going along just fine, reading, laying things out. I got to stone three in the line of John Thompson, then a line right sort of southeast to the bank of Taconi Creek.
Okay.
Then, along the course of Taconi Creek to a stone.
Okay, right.
And over the mill pond to the point of beginning.
Okay.
No distances.
Oh, gee.
Right? So there's a water, right? I wasn't expecting this, but you know, somehow this always happens. So there were no distances given. So basically, the best I could do was there's this gap in the description. When you lay it down on the map, though, they gave an intersection of two roads that I figured out what the modern names of the roads were.
Excellent.
I found the location and I laid it out. And you can see it just sits right there, so you can see where the road. Or where Taconi Creek would have formed the boundary now.
Right.
In the past, there were mill ponds and all kinds of things around it too. So it's sort of iffy. But again, I expect that anybody who has sort of a water boundary on their property description might run into the same.
Excellent. Okay. Well, now, so when you were doing this, you went to a modern map, or were you able to find a historic map?
I found a historic map.
Did it have mill ponds on it?
Oh, it had several mill ponds.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, what Michael's running into is exactly what you're going to run into as well. That this is a great land description for now, but all of a sudden things aren't there that used to be. And we're not talking about a tree or a stone. We're talking about a body of water. So you are going to have to try to find historic maps. And on the handout that I gave you last week, there are lots of different places that I gave you to try to find historic maps. Are they the only places to find historic maps? No. So please, please Google that, because I guarantee you there are thousands more locations where to find them. They may not all be digitized, but then again, that's where you may have to go into a repository and scan something and download that to your computer. And one of the things that I will show you some slides of this, but with this computer, I for whatever reason, it is not allowing me to do an overlay of a map onto Google Earth. I've done it on my computer. I will try to give you the best idea of how we can do this. But one of the things that you will find in your handout for today are lots of links. And I will email you that handout tonight, so you will have those links on your system, so you can just click on it. But the historic maps are what's going to help you relate, and then overlaying them, that can help you lay out the streets. So I will try to show you as much as I can on this, and as I said, I have a couple slides, but well done that you were able to figure it out, and it actually was much easier once you put it on a historic map.
Well, also, though, when I laid it out on a modern map,
right,
the one corner that says at the edge of Taconee Creek, it sat exactly on the edge of Taconee Creek. I didn't fudge this too much. I had to rotate the map a little bit.
Right, okay.
But it worked out surprisingly well, I thought.
Well, and that's the other thing that you're going to have to understand. The surveyors, between their equipment and just the difficulty of surveying with hand tools, there's a lot of imperfections in their measurements. And I know we all like to think that things are going to be exactly where they're supposed to be. Luckily, nobody is going to die if your flat is a little bit off. So luckily, this is not medicine. But it's still going to give you a pretty good idea for genealogy purposes. Fudging is a little okay. I mean, I think you're going to drive yourself crazy if you are trying to get it exactly. Because keep in mind, there are going to be some measurements that are going to be wrong. So if you're holding yourself to that high standard, you're going to really frustrate yourself. And in the long run, you are trying to overlay this on a map. You can get it. Usually what you will find is there are enough geo-reference points, like railroad tracks are wonderful. If there's a building, like a church, as long as you investigate that church wasn't rebuilt or moved. So that's another one that you can do it with. And roads, some of the roads, but keep in mind, roads do change. And you will see on here one that I did, and you'll see things aren't adding up exactly, but it gives you enough of an idea that it works. So, all right, anybody else do a deed for their family? How did it go?
Well, okay. I did actually two deeds, one a larger plot, and then there was a later deed where they sold a strip of that to a neighbor.
Okay.
And I wanted to see where that was. And one thing I ran into was for the smaller strip, there was no length for the long part of it.
Were they just doing it from one neighbor's property to another?
No, it was pretty vague. Yeah, it did say to somebody else's property whose line I didn't have, but what I had to do was only two chains wide, 132 feet wide.
Okay.
And they gave the acreage, 16 acres. So I did some math and
pair
chains and all that stuff.
All of a sudden, your high school math is coming into play here. Who knew that you would be, getting those cobwebs out of your brain and exercising that? Well, great, good. So, and then you actually saw that if they didn't give you some of those things so that you could mathematically do it, that if you had the neighbors, then all of a sudden you start getting into flatting the other neighbors' properties around them. So sometimes that can be very important to try and figure out exactly the dimensions. And then always remember that not only might the surveyor make an error, but then also the clerk who is transcribing this into the recorder of deeds. So you do have to be on your toes for that. And sometimes what I've done when there are bodies of water, you may start to plat it and you get to a certain point and it's a body of water. Sometimes I will go back to the beginning and I will look at it backward. But then you have to switch the north and the south, and the east and the west, and then you come at it from the other direction. So So that's another way that you can deal with it if you're having trouble with a line for one reason or another. So you start from the beginning, and instead of going in the direction they told you, you then look at the directions, and then you come to it backward. But again, you have to flip the north and south and the east and west. So, all right, great. Okay. Using Google Earth. All right, Google Earth, and how many of you have used Google Earth? Okay, all right. For those of you who have already used it, then I'm going to ask you to bear with us while we get everybody else. So in using Google Earth, one of the things that I think is probably, for genealogical purposes, wonderful is overlaying the historic maps. Now, when you're in more populated areas, it's easier to figure out where things are. But if you're in a very rural area, it can be a little bit harder because you have fewer geo-references. But this is one that I did, and I'm going to have to show it to you here because I can't seem to do it on this computer. But the other thing I wanted to show you was over here on Google Earth, and we'll go live to Google Earth in just a minute. Okay, this is my week for bad technology. Actually, I think it's just, I would say probably the month. 3 weeks ago, my car died, and then I had a serious computer issue, and now I can't get things working on here. So don't let me touch any of your computers right now, all right? Clearly, there's some kind of electrical dysfunction going on, and I'm afraid I might damage it. All right, when you look at Google Earth, you're going to see three parts of it. You're going to see the search box at the top. You're going to see places in the middle. And that can go as long as however many things you put in there. And then you're going to see layers on the bottom. And when you're dealing with Google Earth, one of the things that you need to understand is this places area, this is where Google Earth is interacting with your computer. This is kind of the things that are on your computer with Google Earth. And the layers portion of it at the bottom is where it's interacting with the web. So when you are on Google Earth, you always have to not only be on the web, but also if you've done things, you need to be on your computer to access the My Places. So, which is one of the reasons why trying to do it on this computer, I've been downloading as much as I can, and that's why I made these slides. So, now with this particular slide, I'm showing you, I did two things here. I overlaid, and I also have a little box up here. Now, if I click on that X, it's going to disappear. But one of the other things that I want to show you is when you overlay the maps, they have a function in the layers. Okay, this is a bigger picture of it. And you'll see how the roads are lining up. See, the road isn't even here, but you'll see that one there. If it was a little bit longer, you would see how these are lining up. But you can also put a place marker. And you can vary the color of the place markers. You can even put a little circle in it, and you can put initials on it. So if you want all red ones to signify one family or surname and where they moved around in an area, and then you can have other ones in another color that might be another surname that you're tracking. But you can put those in. Now, for the map, you also have this bar over here, this slider. This slider is going to change the opaqueness of your overlay. And you'll see as I go, as this has moved down, and I'll go back to the other one, see how it's higher here? And when we go down, it's lower here. And we go even lower. I'm still leaving a little bit on here. But if you take it all the way to the very end, your overlay completely disappears, which is wonderful. So you have that option of looking at the contemporary map or looking at your historic map and sliding back and forth to keep looking at the different changes that have happened over time. So that's one of the wonderful advantages when you overlay the historic maps. It really brings it home to you as to what has changed over time. You see, we'll take it back and down. So, all right, that's one of the things. The other things that you can do, and now I think what we'll do is I'm just going to go right on to Google Earth and we'll see what happens. So, all right. And I'm going to start up here because this is one of the coolest features of Google Earth. And we're going to go to, we'll go to Burlington, New Jersey. That's why to do this in slides, you are just not doing this justice. So now we're into Burlington here. And what I want to show you is down here on this side, if I want to check or uncheck these things, if I want to put in the roads, the current roads, but I'm going to back out just a little bit. And this is the bar that you use to back out. And I'm going to go over here and I'm going to put click roads. And all of a sudden it's putting all the roads in. And this is tremendously helpful when you are trying to line up and when you're trying to overlay a map and you're doing it by hand. There are some maps that are going to be on Google Earth. I know we talked about David Rumsey and his incredible map collection. I don't think I talked about it last week, but for those of you who are in foundations, I've talked about it before. But he's an incredible map collector, and he actually has digitized a lot of his maps. That link is in the handout from last week. And you can go to those maps, you can download them onto your computer, and then you can upload them and do an overlay, just like this one that I had done, onto your Google Earth. Now, that's if you're doing it by hand, but David Rumsey already has some. Now, he doesn't have nearly as many as I would have liked him to. And unfortunately, he doesn't have a single one for Philadelphia, which is really annoying. Yeah. He's got three for San Francisco. How annoying, but that's where they're located. And they have a couple for New York, but nothing for Philadelphia. All right. So if I'm going to Burlington, New Jersey, and does anybody remember the deed? No. Which deed did you end up doing?
It was Mahan.
Okay, good. All right. I'm getting mixed up here. All right. So that was right at this intersection of Fountain and High. So I'm sure you've done this on Google Maps, but you can also do it on Google Earth, where you take this little guy, the little yellow guy, and you plunk him right down, and I'm going to try and get him right here. I'm coming from way far out. Yeah, see, no.
Whoa.
I'm way far off, so I need to exit Street View because otherwise we're going to be a little bit lost here. And we're going to go out, see how far off we were over here, and this is the intersection I want. So I'm going to go right over here, and I'm going to take him, and I'm going to put him down right here. Oh, hold on. No, I want him right here. And you'll see why in a moment. So this is now taking me from the overhead to what they call the street view. It takes a minute to get into focus. Come on. There we go. All right. So here we have Rita's. This is High Street. And the other that's further back. If we wanted to go down here, now you can do this in two ways to manipulate this. This is going to move you forward and backward. This is going to change your view location. So if I want to look to the right of me, all right, now we're getting a little high, so I'm going to say, okay, let's bring it down lower. And we're going to keep circulating.
and I can do a 360 all the way around. I'm going to keep doing it now. You have to give the images time to refocus again, and it's there you go. But you can do this all the way around. And I'm doing this on purpose because I want to take you down this road. Okay. And we went a little too far, but we'll go back around. It's going to be too close. And we're just going to go a little bit further forward. Nope. Keep going. Now, you can use those. The other thing is you can use the four arrows, your directional keys on your computer, which I actually like using better. I feel like I have a little more control. Hold on. Let me let it focus in. And then I want it to look down. It just keeps going too far. Hold on. And I don't think we're going to be able to quite see this back up a wee bit. See, when I did this at home, I got it just right really fast. But, okay, hold on. We'll try one more time. One more. Okay. All right. Can anybody by any chance read this sign?
Is that what you're trying to do?
Yes. How many times can I walk? Do you know what it says? Mahan. Now, when I did this at home, it went right in front of the sign and you could see it as big as day. But of course, when I'm trying to do it in class, it's not going to. I've never been to this intersection. But this is telling me an awful lot. Because this is exactly where, when we were, we platted out the deed, and when we were looking at the other properties, and it was running right along this road, and this is that main road to Mount Holly. This is right where it ran. And so we know Mahan property was right here. So these are some of the things you might find, and you didn't even have to go to Burlington, New Jersey to see it. So that's one of the fun things that you can play with it. The other thing that I would highly recommend you do is also your addresses in any of the directories, the city directories. You can actually put in an exact address. And I'll put one in now for us, which was 349 Walnut Street. And that is Columbia,
I was using the census records and doing that and adding a picture of the house. If it looked about the age it should have been,
mm-hmm.
for family members and plopping them in ancestry as a picture. Just because it kind of, I mean, it's not exactly as when they lived there, but sometimes, like Ashley, PA, is pretty much exactly as it was.
Right. Okay, wait till it... takes a little while. Come on. And so this is a wonderful way. I'm going to back out because I don't know about you, but I like to get my bearings. So we know that Columbia, the little town of Columbia, is right along the Susquehanna. This is in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And so then we're going to keep zooming in on that site. And actually, let's put the roads in. We've got the roads in. And this is Walnut, okay. This is Walnut Street right here. So, hold on just a second. All right. So, all right, it's on Walnut between 4th and 5th. Okay. So on this particular block of Walnut Street, there's a little church. And of course, now I'm not going to see it at all. Here we go. Okay. So if we want to go down again, do the street view. We've got it. I'm going to circle around here. And the house that I'm looking for is right here, 349 Walnut Street. Now, if I want to continue walking down the street, because I'm interested in seeing the church that they went to. Oops, come on. Keep going straight. And then I'm going to start to turn. Nope, not far enough.
It's right there.
I know. There. Let it come in. And that's the church that my third great grandmother had her confirmation in. And the house down the road was where her father made pretzels, was a pretzel baker. So these are things that you can really get a much better idea of what you're looking at. It's wonderful for when you are start trying to understand. And sometimes when I look at it, I actually find the aerial views when I get close in can be very helpful, because when you're trying to determine, okay, so how did people meet? So the husband lived over here and the wife was over here, but they worked in the middle. And so you understand all of a sudden the proximity. So this is really going to help you, and it may even answer some of your questions. So play with this. Again, it's much easier when you don't have 18 people watching you. No, but it is something that I really think you will find tremendous benefit from. The other thing that you can do is if you have old photographs with houses in the back, or some kind of a house, any kind of landmark that is unique, you can zoom right in on it and make sure and try to identify exactly where the photograph was taken. In one of the exercises, not the exercise, one of the links that you have, Lisa Louise Cook does a wonderful example of this, because she was trying to figure where this photograph was taken. She knew her great-grandparents had lived in two different addresses. So she went to those intersections and looked around, and she did it on both, and actually she saw an unusual cornice on one of the buildings, and she was able to locate that. Now, the only disappointing thing with this is if you have areas, and I had a lot of people that were basically north of Spring Garden Street that have been completely razed, then you're not going to have that, and then you need to rely on the old maps. But it really is very exciting when you have family members that have been in an area and the buildings are still standing. I have a lot of people that were in Baltimore, and I can go right there and I can look at the very same house. And I think that makes a real impact. If you're trying to tell your stories to family members, this is the difference between them paying attention to you and them glazing over. I mean, it really is. And the house may look very different from when they lived in it, you know, 100 years ago or 50 years ago or 75 years ago, but it's a wonderful way for people to relate. So I also use this if you're visiting a repository that you've never been to before and you're trying to see how close the parking is or something. The other thing I've also done, and we're going to go back to Burlington again, really fast. Actually, nothing about this is fast with me today. Okay. We're going to do Broad, and you don't have to just have to do addresses. Broad Street Methodist Church. And that is Burlington. So see, I just put Broad Street United, I just put Broad Street Methodist Church. It came up with United Methodist 3060 Broad Street. Do you see that on the left-hand side up there? So it's, come on, you can do it. But it's going to take me to Broad Street United Methodist Church, and right down the road from the church is the cemetery. I can actually look at some of the stones along the street of the cemetery. Now, keep in mind with this, when you go from... Come on, why aren't you getting in there? When
yeah,
you,
she's getting
in. Yeah, okay. When you go from aerial view to street view, as you start to bring the little man down, you will see blue lines shoot up on the map. That's indicating the places where they are going to have taken photographs that you will be able to do a 360. All right? If they don't have a blue line, you're going to put your little man there, and it's going to take you to the closest blue line where they do have images. So don't think you're doing something, well, you're not doing something wrong, but you're not paying attention to where the blue lines are if you can't go exactly. And again, they're going to have more of these images in the urban areas than they are rural. But it's really neat when you get over to Ireland, too. I know this is Pennsylvania, but I have to say it's very cool when you're doing it all over the world, because it's a whole lot harder. It's easier for me to get to Burlington or Columbia than it is for me to get to Schraubach, Germany. But I have gotten an idea. Come on, why aren't you cooperating? Come on. Here we go. It froze. All right, so here we have Broad Street Methodist Church. And we are going to go in a little bit further, and you're going to see right in here we have lots of gravestones. So this is a wonderful way too to get an idea before you go someplace. And I'm going to take him down and I'm going to put him right there, and he's facing the wrong way, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. He's facing one side of the street and I want him to face the others. So one of the other neat things is if you're telling somebody where they want to look for a gravestone, they've never been there, you can take them on here, and all I have to do is say, okay, see this one here? Not the really tall one, but the one over here? Right on the ground behind it are the two gravestones of Hannah Mahan and Henry Mahan. So that's where they are. So that's one of the things that now when I go into a graveyard, not only do I make note of the people around, I try to find the tallest vertical, because that's much easier for me to direct somebody to than something else. So again, if it's a tree, if it's a something, but I'm not going to be able to go any further into this graveyard. It's only going to take me across the front of it. But you can see in other locations, some of them you can get closer to. I don't know if we're going to be able to. Let's try and go down a little bit. No. But with some graveyards, you can actually see what it says on the stone. But that's only if they're right by the street. Okay, now. So that is the search function. In here we have my places. And as I said, this is the area that if you want to embed a photograph or overlay a historic map, this is where you're going to be doing it. So let's go back. Now we're going to go to a different place. We're going to go to another cemetery. And this one's in Baltimore. And this is going to be Green Cemetery, and this is Baltimore. Also, it can sometimes help you find things. Just be careful. right. So now, I'm going to back out just a little bit here so I can come right over it. And suppose I know that his gravestone is right here because I've mapped it out. So I'm going to click on there. I'm going to go to My Places. I'm going to add one of the things, and you can then just do a place mark. It's going to bring this up. You're going to delete that and put, oops, if you would spell right, Charles. And then we're going to go down here and say OK. And it didn't put it in the right place. OK. So one of the ways that you can do it, if you've made a mistake like that, you can just delete this and start all over again. You also saw on there that it has longitudes and latitude. So you can actually have this interact with the apps like Billion Graves. And I think now they're working on it for Find a Grave, where you have longitude and latitude. I'm going to go in there again, and you'll see that it also has that.
I think they just added it on the
right side. Here. So that if you have the exact longitude and latitude because you've been to a grave site and you've looked it up on Billion Graves, you can then plug that exactly in there, and it'll put it at the exact location. So again, you can mark all the different gravestones. Now the other thing that's fun with this is you can also, again in My Places, and you're right clicking and you're adding, you can add a photo. And again, we can put in here Charles Crooks gravestone. And then it's going to say, add local image. And then it's going to take you to your pictures on your computer. So that's where you already have to have these things loaded in and set up the dimensions the way you want them. So you have to already, and you're going to play with this. And I have to tell you, I don't know what's going on, but every time I load this image, it's turning it sideways. So hopefully on your computer it won't do that. But I want you to see how this operates. So I'm going to hit this, and then we're all going to cock our heads. Give it a second. Sometimes I'll go to My Places and then click it, and there you go. So that you can then go here. Now, if you don't want this there, but you still want to look at other things, fine. Click it off. So you can still look at the map without it. But if you want it, it's right there. So, have any of you done this? It's really wonderful. You have, Michael?
Well, with Google Maps, not with Google.
Okay. Because it really is wonderful, because all of a sudden then you can see, you have the images and you have the option. They're right on your Places button. So they may, until you click on it, that's not going to come up. But you have that there. And you can then, and if you have the place marker and the image, it makes it very clear for somebody else. And then you can send this. You can share this with other people in your family.
Can you print it that way with the tombstone off to the side?
Yes. Yes.
Did Google Earth do the cemetery too? Is that what all those were?
No, those are other people's pictures.
Oh, okay.
So you can put that in there. Yes.
So that means your pictures will join other people's pictures, and other people can see your pictures.
If you said it that way, I think you can keep it private, but honestly, that I'm not sure about.
Can you just select those? That would answer the question,
no.
Wouldn't it?
Oh, wait, hold on. You can pull them off on the side. If you don't want them there, see this button over here? They disappear.
But then yours disappears too, right?
Well, no, because I would then go up here.
Oh, okay.
and I'd click it.
So my point being is, if you...
What I'm addressing is, they may have access to your photo. I can't...
If it's up there, right, is what you're saying.
I don't believe... If you've loaded it on there to the big one, I'm not sure if you can keep it private. Like sometimes on Ancestry, when you scan things in, those photos people can get access to, even though your tree is private.
Well, I think that's part of the Ancestry deal. Does anything you load up, they get to keep? Right?
No, they do not get to keep it, because if you deleted it off of your tree, they don't have it. That's part of Family Search's deal, not Ancestry's.
Okay. Well, but if you die, Ancestry can own your tree if it's not in your legal will.
Right. Well, that I didn't know.
Yes. I can tell you a lot.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that's a new one to me. That one I didn't know. But they, if you delete your photos, then they're not going to stay on there. Where Family Search, you can't delete.
I'm for sharing the stuff digitally.
And you're what?
I'm all for sharing the stuff digitally. And if I were to upload, what I like the idea of, I spent an afternoon in Plattsburgh, New York, photographing the cemetery.
Well, I actually think it's good to share things, but there are some photos people don't want to share.
Absolutely.
And actually, there are some of the time, what I'll do is I'll put some things up, but then I keep one or two things so I have to trade with cousins. So that I have a little bit to barter. So whet their appetite and then barter. All right. Okay, let me just see. The other thing on here, and I'm not going to go, oh, I wanted to show you David Rumsey's. Okay. Now, when you are going down, for David Rumsey's, since he has already put those on here and they are there forever, what you want to do to find his things that he already has, you go to gallery and you click that, and you wait a minute. And we're going to have to go way out because I don't think he has anything on Baltimore either. He's a little West Coast biased. But in just a minute, you're going to see different things load up here. One of them is David Rumsey's, and you'll see little starbursts. And if you go to those, he has historic maps embedded already, overlaid, and they're already... They're already at the proper scale.
Those pictures that were on there before that you were able to elect to take off, were they also tombstones typically? Is what that?
I would have to go and look. It depends. I mean, they may be a tombstone. They may be a picture of the person. It's whatever the person put in there.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's completely up to the individual that's loading that on there. Okay. And come on. There we go. And why isn't this working? Come on. All right. Here we go. Okay. And David Rumsey's maps. So we're going to click on that. Map finder. All right, while we're waiting for that, the other thing that I just want to show you here is, if you are overlaying an image, and I know this isn't going to work, okay, so I'm just telling you that right now, and first of all, I'm going to... Do you see how right away it put these things on here? It has a center cross, and it has one side, another side. This is an incredibly large map. Mm-hmm. Another side, here's a corner. What I will do, let's go way in. We're going to go to another part of the... Well, I'm going to delete this one. Just so you know, I'm going to show you how you can delete and nobody's the wiser. So let's go, we're going to go back to Greenmount. And if I was going to overlay the image, I actually had the map of Greenmount Cemetery, but it will not, for whatever reason, let me load it. So if I were going to places and I wanted to do an overlay, I'm going to hit this. Now, right away, we're going to go out. Do you see it's giving me the dimensions of the map? So if I wanted to make the map smaller, we're going to pretend there's a map on there, okay? And then I'm going to take it in further. And whether it has a flat hand, it means you can move it. If it has a point, you're going to be stretching it. So, see, this is going to stretch the map. Do you see? So when you're doing a map and you're overlaying it, you're going to be overlaying it. First of all, you want to have the image that you're seeing Google Earth in as close to the scale or the dimensions of your map to begin with. Just, I know this is just a visual. And then it's going to overlay that. And then you are going to manipulate the corners and the sides to get your, to anchor your map onto Google Earth. Once you close this box down below, it's anchored. So if you're still manipulating it, or you think you want it, you do not want to close that box. You want to leave it open. You saw how I've moved it all the way down to the bottom where it says Google Earth New Image Overlay. I have it all the way down at the bottom because I'm going to keep fooling with that. Because once I close it, it's anchored, and the only way that you, then you have to either delete it and start all over again. So it can take you a little while to do this. But it's very cool, particularly if you have some kind of little small map that's in a book that's not online. You download it to your computer. You then hit it. You have a way of going to a local image and putting it up on here and then stretching it to make it work. So, all right, let's see if we can try one more time with David how we're doing down here. Map finder, come on. And what we'll do is I'm going to go to San Francisco because I know there are a ton of them there.
I have a question about this.
Yes.
So, and the only way to access the overlay again is between is through your computer using Google Earth, correct?
Okay.
In other words, this anchored map is not floating around somewhere.
The anchored map is going to be anchored onto that particular geographic location.
And anyone can see it?
I do not believe they can with the maps, no.
Because what I'm trying to say, what I'm trying to ask is this a relationship between my database, what's on my computer, and what's on Google Map, or is this now something that's living independently attached to Google Map?
If you are linking a web image and you've done it with a link, then it's going to be on there. If you're doing it strictly from your computer, it is not going to be permanently on there. That is my understanding. I have to be honest with you, I have not played with it enough to answer that question fully. So, all right, so this is San Francisco. Okay, here we go. We have one right here. See this little compass? This is going to be, and let's go into, come on. I'm going to close this out because I think it's, we're going to close that. And then we will go in here. And it's telling you the information. And this is, and it says to overlay the map on Google Earth, clip the map. Thumbnail. Come on. Come on. And now I can't even get it to. Okay.
It is a little slow.
There's no indicator, like an hourglass or anything that tells you it's still
working. I know. So it's, you know what, I'm not going to take any more time, but I just wanted to give you all an idea of some of the things you can do with Google Earth. And when you're working on your own computer, it will be much easier. Because one, you're going to get, there are little, it can be tricky in that when you're placing things, different things are going to have a different feel depending on the computer that you're on. But there are wonderful things you can do. The other thing you can do on here is, if you look on your handout, I have use other tools like EarthPro to display property and public land survey systems. And I've given you the link there. If you have any, and again, I know this is in Pennsylvania, but if you have anybody in your family that has public surveyed land, you can go on this and you can take the coordinates right off of the public survey on the Bureau of Land Management and plug them right into the Earth point, and it will pull you right to the property and you can zoom in on it on Google Earth. So right away you're getting right to it just from the land description that's on the federal land description. So, and then I'm trying to think. The tools that I think are wonderful here, Lisa Louise Cooks, that's a wonderful one to just get a feel for it. She also shows you another thing that you can do, that you can do a little tour. It's almost like a driving tour of your family, their migration. If someone has, she does one of a family member and their occupation. And at one particular time, he worked for a automobile company, and another time he was working for an estate. So she actually takes you to the different locations, and at each location a different photograph comes up. So it really can be a wonderful way. Again, I think this is a great thing to engage your family members and your children. I will say it does take some time. And then the other one, Google Earth Learn, is very good because it actually takes you step by step through how to do different functions on here. So again, I so appreciate you bearing with me while I was limping my way through using this different computer. But I hope this gives you an idea of some of the things you can do. So, all right, questions? Yes?
Do you have to pay for Google Earth?
No, that's the wonderful thing. It is free. To download it is incredibly easy. All you do is you just Google Earth Pro, and you want the desktop version. But they also have apps that you can do for mobile devices. Mm-hmm. So you can also do this. So imagine when you're out in the graveyard trying to do some of this.
It's a little
wonky. It's wonderful.
I use the mobile. It's a little wonky, but it does work similar. But some of this I've
Well, you definitely saw how wonky this could be. And I'm sorry we couldn't see one of David Ramsey's maps. But you can. That will give you something to play with at home. So, all right, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
We have to load the computer up, so just take a 5-minute break and we'll be right back with you. Anybody in here Welsh? Mark Welsh? I just want to show you a deed I came across in Chester County, which is just a wonderful deed. So when you just think of deeds for land, it's not necessarily true. Here's a question I have for you. Abias Stevens of Welsh descent dies in 1802 in Chester County. Who was his father?
Mr. Stevens.
You've been
Stevens something or other.
Oh, yeah, they do.
I mean, Stephen would have been the father's first name.
Right.
Correct.
Yes.
Now it's explained in a deed. So if we look at Abias Stevens, died in 1802, will prove for December 1802. There's really no enlightenment on parental names there if you're not familiar with the Welsh patrimony. So you review the abstract of wills of Chester County, you find that Mary Stevens was son Abia. So Mary Stevens died in 1784, and her will was proved 14 February 1784. And it mentions son Abiah Stephen, among others, but no husband. So the next line of research. What question? Come on.
Land records.
There's the deed from Mary Stevens to her son Abiah. For some reason, I'm tripping over that today. Anyway, it starts right here, and it goes through the page and another half page down to here. But what it reads in part is, this indenture tripartite, three people, made the 29th day of December in the year of our Lord, 1759, between Mary Stevens of a different township in the county of Chester and province of Pennsylvania, widow and relic of Stephen Evans, late of said township, yeoman deceased from the one part. So is this a clue?
Yeah.
Did Mary Stevens been married?
Not as of here, but real quick, why is she referred to as a prophet?
There was no political correctness in that.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't
saying
something.
No, it's just a terminology that they used to indicate that she was the older or the surviving wife of the.
She was a spinster.
Just because
you're not married at 21.
Oh. Spinster. All right, so the will goes on to read. David Stevens of the said township, yeoman, eldest son of said Stephen Evans, the widow and children according to the Welsh custom, taking their surname, the Christian name of the father. And Elizabeth, his wife, on the second part. So David Stevens has a wife, Elizabeth. And Abiah Stevens of the township yeoman of the third part. So there's your three people. You have mom and the two sons. So if you look at Welsh patronymics, Stephen Evans marries Mary Rees. Mary Rees becomes Mary Stevens because they take the Christian name or the forename of the father and she adopts that. And then all the children will become a Stevens. Don't ask me why, but this is the way it is. And this is found in a deed, so it's actually pretty interesting. So if we were to talk about this Elizabeth, wife of David Stevens, what would her surname be?
David.
Following Welsh custom, of course. Now this didn't last very long, and that's what's unique about this will, I think, is that they were still using this custom into the 1700s. A lot of the Welsh that came over in the early... or the late 1690s and early 1710 period, immediately started adapting the English customs. So you didn't have to worry about this. But what's unique about this case as well is that where's Dad's will? It was confirming and compounding the circumstance because it was filed in 1754 in Philadelphia, even though it's a Chester County family. He may have been business in there, whatever the case, but that's where it is. And it mentions his wife, Mary, and Abiah. So if you're going backwards, as we teach in genealogy, and you get to Abiah, you have to think about whether he's Welsh or not to be able to find his dad or his mom, because the last name's not going to be the same. So it's just something to think about.
How did you come to know that he was Welsh? Was that the first one? That was it. Okay. All right. I just...
Widow and children according to the Welsh custom.
Okay. I'm sorry.
And if you're from Chester County, you'll know that a large area of the main line of Pennsylvania Railroad has all been Welsh settled. That was the Welsh tract that had been granted to Thomas Holmes.
The deed said what is in red?
Yes, it did.
Oh, it did?
Oh, that's exactly right. I just highlighted it so that you understand.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how it appears in the deed.
So
you never know what you're going to find.
Similar to the Scottish way of first brother, first sister, father.
Yeah, if you know the Scottish and Irish names, yeah. But this is specific here.
And he said most of that ended when they got here in the early 1800s.
Most of them transitioned to the English way, that's correct. Where, you know, the father's name would be the one that was adopted. The father's surname would be, in other words, Richard Evans would have been, or Stephen Evans would have been married to Mary Evans at that point. But in this case, not, because she adopted the old Welsh custom of Mary Stevens.
That's scary.
So,
no.
All right. Let's talk about the homework. Who has found the 104-acre property of William Warren's purchased by Peter Biggs, from Peter Biggs? One?
That feels bad.
Everybody understands why it's 104 acres?
Yeah.
What's it look like?
Puzzle.
Anybody think it's one? Anybody think it's two? Anybody think it's three? How about four? Everybody think it's four? How about five? Six? It's got to be one of them. Who thinks six? Okay. Anybody think five? Right. Let's talk about the deed. This is the William Barnes property. This is the house. It's the Barnes Britton house. It's in down near Chatsford in Chester County. It's a beautiful old stone, apartment brick house. And there's a long history to it, 1714. But no one has ever really identified the property of William Barnes. I was hoping you guys could do that. Maybe that's why. Okay, the first one we have, first description we come in across in the deed is Richard Few to James Few land description, right? So we want to write that out, just as Sydney was telling you. She gave you a form where you can fill in the blanks, or you just follow this format, beginning at a post in the line formerly of Peter Dix, thence west 177 purchased by land formerly of Peter Dix, and land of John Hope to a corner marked Black Oak. So west 177 purchase, that's pretty easy. Then south by land of John Packer, 117 purchase to a marked White Oak. That's pretty easy. We're going west, we're going south. Then east by land of Richard Fletcher, there's our Fletcher name, 225 purchase to a post. So we've come west, we've gone east, or south rather, now we're going east. And then north, 17 west, 48 purchase, and north 30 west, 78 purchase to the place of beginning. And that encompasses 152 acres according to Steve, correct?
Yep.
Is everybody following me?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, for the benefit of those who might have missed last week, north 17 west, the north part of the compass is here, top half, south is the bottom half. It's either west or east when it's indicated. So we're going north 17 west. We're going north, we're going 17 degrees, and it's west. If it was south, we'd be down here 17 degrees west or east, depending on the number. It's very simple. Remember, north 30 west. There's 30, it's north, and it's west of the east-west line. And that property is going to look like that when it's deeded out. We've come west, we've gone south, we've gone east, and we've gone 17 and 30.
How did you end up with 147.3 acres?
The computer figured that out.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm using DeepMapper to do this because it lines it out. That's where you have, this is modern technology. That's why you have to be real loose with the deeds that you were looking at, particularly the earlier the deed, is the amount of acreage that they talked about. It's not going to be exact. These measurements are not going to be exact. You can see that little point right there is not accurate. That shouldn't be 70 or 30, rather. That should be about, what, 28, something like that, maybe. But you have to realize if you're dealing with a surveyor who is using a magnetic compass or shooting stars out there. So it's going to be inaccurate the earlier the deeds get. So that's Richard Few to James Few. Is everybody happy with that?
Yeah.
All right, William Barnes land description. This is partial. Beginning at a black oak, corner of William Harvey. thence northwest by north by land of William Harvey, 82 purchased to a post. Then south 44 west by land of John Way, 38 purchased to a black oak. Then south 15 west by land, then of William Barnes, 41 purchased. So we know Barnes has land that's adjacent to that measurement right there. Thence west by the same land, 6 purchased to a post. Then south, 2 purchased to a post. Thence north, 89 east, by other land of James Few and land of William Harvey. That encompasses a whole 20.25 acres of the 103.75 acres William Barnes purchased, or the 104 acres if you want to round it off. So what he's doing is describing 20 acres of land that James Few owned, or received somewhere, out of 103 acres that William Barnes originally purchased. And that's at the very bottom of the first page, correct? Does everybody agree with that on my math? Okay. So that's going to look like that. We've come northwest by north. Remember the old compass we had? That's a very unreliable indication, but that's the way they've drawn it here. See, there's northwest by north, and then we're coming to south 44 purchased, and here's the William Barnes property, south 44 west. But here's the land of the formerly owned by William Barnes. This track, this piece right here, is what they say William Barnes owned over here somewhere. We don't know how much or anything, but we know it was William Barnes' property, because all these were Harvey and Hope and all those other folks. Correct? Mm-hmm. Everybody follow that? So what are we missing? Peter Dix?
Yeah.
What land does he have? Is there an indication of it in there?
255 acres.
Pardon me?
225 acres?
Yeah.
The 83
acre report? All it says is Peter Dix. Mm-hmm. Doesn't give a description of his property at all in the deed that I was on. Mm-hmm. So what do we have to do? We have to find Peter Dix's land, right? And that was one of my hints. Where can we find Peter Dix's land? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. If it's an original survey, we have to go to the State Archives. That was our first week of class. And look in the old rights of Chester County. And there's the land index. This land records indices page is really important, and it looks like that we talked about. There's the old rights index, Bucks and Chester counties.
And why is it we're looking in there?
Pardon?
Why is it we're looking in there?
Because that's where it will be.
If it's there.
If it's there. If it's there. That's what it's going to be. Because you're pre-1933 and you're looking for an original survey. Or you're looking for an original index.
So why, okay, so my thinking is why if I'm thinking, okay, it's original or it's an original purchase. Is it because it's a survey that it's in the old rights index, or is it because...
It's because it's in Bucks, Chester, or Philadelphia counties. Those three counties are the old rights counties. As you get down there, you're just looking for original purchase registers if it's outside those counties.
If it's what? Say that again?
If it's outside of those three counties, you're looking at the original purchase register for land before 1733...
Okay.
But because this was, Barnes was in Chester County, we know it's an old rights county.
Okay.
In other words, it's one of the original counties that Penn set up, and they call it the old rights.
But we don't know from the deed that Peter Dix actually was, that he was the person for whom the land was surveyed.
We have to assume that because it's a 1731 assumption.
Right. But it could be possible if we didn't find it, then he had bought the land, forgotten the land from somebody else.
That's right, and where would that deed be?
On Frank.
Thank you.
It's going to be in the county. Because only the original
yes,
patent
yes.
comes
okay.
out of the state.
Remember that corner?
Then after that, all the transfers of land would be in the county. Right?
Yes.
So we're just looking for. I've already checked and told you that the head was, you're going to have to look in the state records. I'm giving you a favor here. All right, so we're going to go to the old rights index at Bucks and Chester counties. And this is where I created a little bit of a curve, and I didn't do it intentionally, but the index of Chester County old rights listings, you do it by, his name was Dix, and there's D's right there. And if we go to page 12, we're going to find two Dixes on there, Peter Dix, but it's not the property because it's not the right acreage. And they're both east of the Brandywine River, the creek. So we have to look at location, and we have to look at age, acreage is what we're doing. And you have to make sure that there's, you look at the register and make sure that you see that there's a D there. So you better go on page 13 and see. And there's another Dix right there, Peter, 554 acres in 1701. D89, page 6, is the survey. Now, when we talked about this, we just looked at a lot of surveys with the meets and bounds description. But there's also some of the old ones only have the narrative. And that's what I've passed out to you today. But how do we find that? We go back to the indices page, and we look at survey and survey products, and we look at the copied survey books to start. So we know we're going to D89, which is going to be down over here. We click on D89, and page 6, which is right here, and that's going to give us our copied survey. And it's a meets and bounds description. So here's another meets and bounds you've got to figure out. Another platting. Is everybody with me so far?
Yes, but I have to say, could you go back one page? Where you, before that page, that's the copied survey page. So I never could figure out how to get there. I just could not remember or figure out how I'm supposed to go someplace forward with the information that you gave me with, you know, the D89 page 6. So if you're on that page with all the way at the top in the search bar, I plugged that information in and it took me right to it.
Okay.
Which I was glad to have the information, but I couldn't figure out how to get it.
Right.
Like, it made me insane. I just could not figure out how to get it.
Okay.
So now I know it's...
Just remember that this land records page right here, land records indices, has these all, and this goes on down, the list goes right on down like that, and down over in this area here would be the copy survey.
Actually, could you go back to the old rights, show the Dix, go back to the page. Okay, look over to the edge. Do you see there where it says D...
89.6.
That's exactly the number you're looking for in
these
copy, survey copy
books. Yeah, but
you couldn't. I didn't know where to go with that information. I had the information and plugged it into the search bar because I couldn't figure out where I was supposed to click on to plug that in.
Well, we're going to go there.
Yes. And then you go
literally. You can go here, but she put it.
I couldn't figure out the page before this. Where it says the copy survey books, I could not figure out that's
that,
where I needed to go.
She put D89 into the search bar, and then came up and gave me this page here.
Right.
So then we're D89, and then we go to page 6.
Right.
And that gives us our narrative survey.
But you could have D89-1, D89-2, D89-2.
Absolutely.
You've got hundreds of pages. So you know
that's right. Pages. That's why this is just the bottom of the whole list here. There's this top. You see D starts with 1, comes all the way down to 89.
But also weirdly, if you look at if you were to download that onto your computer, the name that they give it is a different name. In other words, it'll come up D89 page 472 for some weird reason.
That's one of the.
So I have to change every time I write down these pages to be able to refine them. I had to change them back to their original D89.6.
Okay. I'm a little confused, but maybe we can talk about it
after.
D89.6, that's the page that comes up, and that's where the narrative summary of the Dix and Bounds is. So then we do Peter Dix's land description. Beginning at a black oak on the west side of Brandywine Creek and corner of Robert Way's land. Then south 44 west. Have we seen that before? We saw on that little tract of William Barnes's property, right? By land of Robert Way, 298 purchased to a black oak. That's 45 west by land of Robert Way. So we're doing a right turn there, going from south 44 to north 45, both west. 293 purchased to a white oak. Thence 44 west by vacant land, 130th purchase to a Spanish oak. Then south 46 east by land of John Hope, 224 purchase to a hickory. Thence 89 east by reputed land of Thomas Rowland and Thomas Hope, 510 purchase to a beech tree by the Brandywine. Thence up the creek. Sometimes you'll see meander. What they're doing is they're following the course of the creek. And some surveyors are called meander, some will say up the creek, some will say down the creek. This class was probably up the creek. 309 purchase to the place of the beginning. But it encompasses 554 acres, which is what was indicated on the V89-6 page. Okay, so does everybody understand where we've gotten this? This is our third plat in this exercise. We've plat out the few exchange. We've plat out the William Barnes 20 acres, and we've platted now Peter Dix's land. So how does this fit together? I don't know. There's what it looks like in the drawing. This is Robert Way, we know, because we've turned a corner and it was indicated that Way had both lines. So we know up here Robert Way would own that. If we're going to put a whole bunch of deeds together, that's who we'd work on next, probably. But for right now, this is the property that Peter Dix was granted. And he sold a portion of that to William Barnes, correct? The deed tells us that. Can we fit the 20.75 acres of William Barnes' land into Peter Dix's land? Can we fit it in? That's what you have to say.
Well, it's less than 5.
But it fits right there. Because you've got this South 44 West mark right here. And you've got this dimension here in that same line. So now we know where 20 acres of William Barnes' land is, and we know from previous discussion that this part here was also William Barnes' land. Because it told us in that earlier description, right? James View. Everybody following me?
But it's simply the fact that they fit, that it fits in that spot. Because there's no other, there's nothing in the deed of the smaller piece that says that we position it relative to the creek or anything else. It's just because it fits.
Just because it fits. Okay.
And also you're taking the bottom line, so to say.
That's right. This north 89 east is the same on both of them, and this south 44 west is the same on both of them. Now, this one had a little blurb where it went 5 down 2 and then back these. But it's such a small area, they're almost irrelevant in the big scheme of things here. Everybody follow what I've done?
Yes, and then the pink is Peter Dix's land. The outline.
The big outline is Peter Dix's land.
Okay.
And then this is William Barnes's original 20 acres.
Okay.
But he had 104 acres, so we still have to find that. Correct? Okay, James Few to James Britton land description. This is the actual deed transcription in 1859. Beginning at a hickory, then south by land of John Packer, 117 purchase to a white oak, then east by land of Richard Fletcher, now William Harvey, 225 purchase to a post. That sounds familiar to me. Didn't we just do that? We went east, west, south, east. Now we're just going south and east. Thence north 17 west, 48 purchase. North 30 west, 78 purchase. North 89, 43 purches. Northwest by north by land of William Harvey. South 44 west by land of John Way. Boy, those two sound familiar too, don't they? The little piece. Okay. Thence 46 west by the same land, 113 purchase to a hickory. Then south 44 west by land of John Hope, 109 purchase. Then south 69 east, 5.5 purchases. Then south 10 west, 48 purchases. Then north 89 east, 18 purchase to the first mentioned hickory. That encompasses 255 acres. Anybody have a feel for what that looks like? Okay, so here is where William Barnes' property was. This is the property we've already identified as Richard to James Few. So James Few is just adding property to sell to that that he previously acquired somewhere. Correct? And it happens to include, if we remember back, there's Sydney's technology coming up. This little line down here, this is Williams Barnes property somewhere up in here. So can we fit James Chew's land into Peter Dix's? Certainly we can. Look at that. Did Peter Dix own this property? Not according to the survey. So we can take that out of there. And what does that leave us with? Leaves us with this. Now this over here, there's probably been some sale of land or something. Doesn't fit exactly. But if you look at that right there, that's 79 acres if you line it up with Peter Dix's property. And that's pretty close to 104 acres. It's 107, I believe. 3 acres amongst friends and 1720 is nothing. So, we know that this is William Barnes' property, the rest of it, because the acreage almost accumulates to the acreage that was indicated in the deed of total 104, and because this property right here was identified as belonging to William Barnes. So we have our William Barnes 20 acres, we have our William Barnes 40 acres, it looks like so. Everybody agree with me? Anybody want to fight me? William Barnes' property by meets and bounds. We can actually decide what the meets and bounds are. And as you can see, it's 107 acres. But if we started that black oak in the line of Peter, go northwest by north 82, we can come southwest, south 44, west 38. We can go north 46, west 113. We go south 44 west 132. These are all indicated. These are all in the deed already. And then we go south 46 east. That's something you have to figure out by joining the line of north 89 east. You're sort of backing this over here like this and see where this line fits in Peter Dixon. Measure the distance with your ruler. Piece of cake.
Will you email us to us?
Yes, I will. I didn't want to do it ahead of time. I didn't want you to be smarter than I was.
So is it typical that you would come to the end of something that's frustrating and figure out that you're roughly 100 acres, 101 acres, give or take a little bit, like you said, and that it's pretty much normal that it could turn out to be a few acres shy of what you expected?
Could be a few shy or could be a few more.
But you shouldn't expect it to act perfectly, and that's why you're okay.
That's why I'm going through this. You will never, very seldom, unless it's a square, do you find a perfect acreage calculation or a perfect, unless it's really a good survey.
So is this
because very meticulous how they move their chains, et cetera, et cetera.
So yeah. Is this because of the shape that we find this scenario, or is it because of the time frame of the different parceling? Or is
this
it
you're going to find this at all different time frames. Particularly in Pennsylvania because it's a meets and bounds state. This is just typical meets and bounds. The earlier it is, the less accurate it's going to be, though, because of the inaccuracies of the measuring equipment. The further west you get toward the mountains, the inaccuracy, because they have to use the rods and chains differently to measure the flatness of the earth, which they don't have. So
it's more about the shape, not so much
about the
parceling,
shape. Right.
Constant breaking up or division. It's more about the shape
how it started. Well, you have to go through all these divisions and everything to find the shape to get back to the original property that William Barnes bought from Peter Dix.
Considering the irregularities involved with meets and bounds especially, I guess, how in the world did they calculate acreage with any degree of accuracy?
Yes.
They calculated it by adding and subtracting and, or, you know, using their formulas to correlating. And that's why I never added up to the right one, because they didn't have the sophistication of GPS, etc., to figure out what the right angle here was and what the where to draw this line to figure out this, or if they were going to draw it this way and use that one and then add this one. It was up to the individual surveyor, and each surveyor was different in his ability. Some were good, better than others. William Barnes land description, it's 107 acres, we've already read through that. Anybody pick it out here? Cindy already showed you what Google Earth is like. See this boundary right here?
Yeah.
Look at this boundary right here. Here like that.
Oh my gosh.
There's Peter Dix's property. Some of those boundaries still exist. Here's William Barnes' property as we figured it. And there's William Barnes' house that I showed you right there off the road, Route 1. See how much fun deeds are? Questions on that? I'm going to show you another one. What time we got here? This is John Stringer. This one I'm a little less sure of because it's a little less accurate. But I wanted to show you, we have been dealing with land records. In other words, a recorder has recorded all these records in a book. Well, in the early days, and this is 1704, all they did was record the sale in the Common Pleas, in the case of Pennsylvania, the Common Pleas Court, or the Quarter Sessions Court, is where the buyer and the seller would come in and say, I sold this land to so-and-so. And that's all they ever did. There's no description of the land or anything. So that leaves us with the magic obligation of figuring out how they've done it. Well, anyway, quarter sessions held in Chester, Forsyth County, on the 30th day of May, 1704. John Willis, by his attorney Isaac Taylor, for those of you who know Isaac Taylor, he's a lawyer and also a surveyor, delivered a deed to John Stringer for 30 acres of land in Thornbury, dated the 29th of February, 1703. Now, if you look at the abstracts of deeds for Chester County, there's only one other place John Stringer's name comes in Thornbury in any deed mentioned. You all know that you can buy a book. Most counties will have a deed abstract book. It's a lot of the names will be listed in the back alphabetically, so you can certainly do that. It's easier than trying to figure it out yourself. This is what it looks like in the court record. Two narrative lines. 1704. And that's the only record we have of that John Stringer buying that property from John Willis. So how do we think about how we're going to try and find that property now? Who are we going to look for first?
Isaac
Taylor. Yeah. Yeah.
See, he said the same thing in the records of his surveying. That would have been
the
first thought.
I'd go to old rights and see if I can find books.
Well, that's good. That's very good. Absolutely. Unfortunately, he's not in the old rights. John Simcock owned the property before John Willis, but it is the county deed records that we have of John Willis. John Willis is selling property to Henry Hale. Let me just say that John Willis's original patent is not listed, the original deed is not listed when he purchased from John Simcock. John Simcock was a big landowner in Philadelphia, Montgomery, Chester, and Bucks counties, and they divided it up into 1,500-acre plots and 5,000-acre plots for the different areas. So you need to know that John Simcock was the original owner. You can go to some of the maps and atlases that are been developed in the 1880s to actually depict some of these, and I'll show you a picture of that. But there is no plot per se of John Willis in itself, in and of itself. In other words, a meets and bounds description. So all the first place John Willis comes to mind here is in Henry Nail's selling some land to Henry. And he's beginning at a hickory, beginning at a corner of another track of Henry, then 66 East by 19, North 24 by the land of John Willis, 34 perches, South 66 West in the line of John Willis and John Stringer. So John Stringer owned property next to John Willis. So Willis, when he sold that property, it was a piece of his property, and he never got rid of the property next to him, at least when this deed was written. And then south-southeast by the land of John Davis, the place at the beginning, which contained 25 acres. So this 25 acres is being sold to Henry Nail. And that's what it looks like. Here's John Willis over here. Here's John Willis along here, and John Stringer along here. And that's what we've got. There's John Davis, and here's the Henry Nail's corner. This is another piece. That's not the same piece, because it says another piece at the corner. So Henry's buying some property from the people there. This is an old deed book. Smith made a deed book of early patents for Delaware County, which so would be after 1789. But here's John Yearsley. John Yearsley bought 500 acres from John Simcock. You can see John Simcock was the original owner here. John Yearsley sold 250 acres to John Willis when John Yearsley came over from England in 1701. John Yearsley's wife was a Simcock. So that was the connection there. What the connection with John Willis is, other than just a land purchaser, I don't know. Now, this is what Smith thinks John Willis's land looked like. But we don't know for sure, because there's no deed to tell us. And you can see that Thornbury Township, where this is located in Chester County, now Chester County, extends a little bit further than these deeds. And we'll show you that here in Google. This is my expectation. John Yearsley purchased this property. Here's John Willis that I see, and I think this is the property that he's selling to Henry Nails. I don't know whether Naylor owns one of these or not, but John Davis owns this property, and I think this is John Springer's property. I'm still working on this. But you can see how complicated it gets with these early deeds, because you don't have the information. You're having to reconstruct all this. Anybody that's familiar with Chester County, all this is Route 926. Street Road. And it stops right here at Route 202. Darlington's Corner, I believe. So the Yearsley property is here. This is the Willis property. There's some pretty good outlines here of property. They're a little bit bigger than the 30 acres that indicated in the sale here. So that's why I'm not sure that these are the exact dimensions of the property. But I think that's where John Stringer's property was. Again, this is Route 926 right along here. This is Route 202 down toward Chatsford. This is the Birmingham meeting. So this whole area was part of the Battle of Brandywine. Now, John Stringer sold this property. Because in 1737, I believe it was, he got a patent out in West Fallowfield. There's no record of who he sold it to. So, you know, you're going to come across these circumstances where people have not filed or recorded their deeds. They've just been passed down from family members, or the people that were purchasing the deed didn't need to see an effort to record these deeds. So you're just going to have to make educated guesses about what to do. That's why planning is so important, to have an understanding of what you're doing and what the directions are telling you. And follow the property lines of people that are adjacent to your property, because maybe their deeds are recorded, and then we can go back and figure out where that other piece of property sits.
So when you have one like this and you're trying to figure it out, and let's just say you just can't figure it out, there's just not enough information. Like when a property is sold somewhere in there, something's been connected through title. Somewhere. There's a chain somewhere. So what kind of information can you gather that way from the courthouse and go backwards? If you have to. I mean, that's a long way back, I realize. But
you're making the assumption that the title company has assumed that they have gone back. They have gone back far enough for their methods to assume that that title is good. They're not necessarily going back to the original owner.
Well, they had to start somewhere, is my point.
That's right. They did have to start somewhere. Their start was probably most convenient to them. So they know that later on in, say, the 1880s, this was owned by the Dilworths. That might be good enough for that title company to say, well, I knew the Dilworths owned that land. There was no need to title it further.
So that means potentially there's a lot of cloudy title out there that's not.
That's potential, but how are you gonna prove your claim?
Wouldn't they have to prove their claim to you as the owner? You see what I'm saying? Like if you were to dispute, like let's say somebody, I guess, and my question only comes up, but if somebody got hurt on your property, and you knew that it was a little sliver of property that has been under dispute for years and years and years, would it befall you to prove that, or would it be something that you could go back to your title?
Your mortgage company wouldn't have let you buy that property without title insurance.
Because they were comfortable with what the title search has claimed.
That's correct.
Yeah. So then it falls on
the title. So if that person that's injured on your property is going to go back prior to the title search to claim ownership or whatever it is, and that's normally what it is, it's not so much injury. Injury is a current thing.
Right, it's about ownership, and that's why you have insurance.
Right.
But I guess that's my question is more of a legal one. Like who's
if somebody came up and said, my name is John Stringer and I own this property, then, or I'm a descendant of John Stringer and I've got the proof of deeds, then that title company is going to be held accountable.
That's my question. So
and if they prove it's sufficient, then John Stringer's descendants would own that property and the people that bought it would be kicked out. Because the title company would insure their restitution.
Or wouldn't be able to prove what they assume.
The title company wouldn't be able to prove it, yeah. There's a lot of deeds out there, I'm sure, that the title company's the only one. I think in talking with some of them at the courthouse now, they only go back 3 or 4 deeds,
yeah,
or maybe 50 years to 100 years to make sure that there's no adverse actions against that property. And if there's not, they're satisfied with that. They're not going to go back to 1704.
Well, they don't have to because they're dead. And there's going to be really likely to dispute. But I guess that was why my question, if going back in like certain time frames, those people during those time frames before, as we're like now we're in title searches at that, that's what we did. But even 100 years ago, is it something that we're likely to run into in doing search in certain time frames that we have to be careful of because of disputes or legalities that came up?
Not unless you know there's a dispute. For instance, if you're up in northeastern Pennsylvania, where the Susquehanna company came in from Connecticut, and there was land disputes there. Well, that was settled, but there's always the potential for disputes. If another deed were to show up from Connecticut, Pennsylvania has already stated that, no, we're not going to honor those deeds anymore from this such and such date. So I think in most cases where there was dispute or there's potential for dispute, it's been
pretty much figured out now. I just wondered, like, in researching certain time frames, if there's things like that to look out for.
You have to know the historical context of the property you're dealing with and the time frame you're doing it. Absolutely. Sydney's ready to hand out some diplomas. I hope everybody's learned something.
Because I didn't get
this part. I'll look the name up for you. But he did a 1784. And that's what Smith is done.
So he bars on that.
Oh, he's still listed in the New England.
That's all he did.
Oh, yeah.
That's what he's saying.
I'm wondering why he did this. He's written by a rational tissue, but there isn't here.
That the archivists don't know everything that's in here? That is true for many, many repositories. So sometimes you can be looking for something and you will find something that the archivist didn't know was there. So that's why I'm, yes, ask the archivist, but look yourself. Because you never know. There's a person at the National Archives, his entire job it is to try to determine whether indeed they do have the things they claim on the National Archives catalog, or whether they have more than what they say they have on the National Archives catalog. So this is trying to keep track of all this information and documentation is a huge task, absolutely huge. So I think we're going to get ready to hand out your certificates. And the other thing, I have brought chocolate to remind you that when you go to these repositories or city halls or libraries or churches or cemeteries, it is always a good idea to bring something. Very important.